States Dressage Federation's official podcast. Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Chris Stafford. On this week's episode, we'll be hearing from Jessica Runshausen as she gives us some tips on training to coincide with a recent article in Connection magazine. But before that, we have part one of a session that was taken from the 2013 Adequan USDF Annual Convention on saddle fitting featuring Jochen Schleser.
Saddle Fit for Life was formed in 2006 as a separately incorporated company. We wanted to be able to promote the education. Unfortunately, Jochen Schleser is its chief trainer, and that kind of combines with Schleser, the manufacturer, so it's very difficult sometimes to keep those two apart. But Saddle Fit for Life is all about the education of saddle fit, and we have a global network. We are hardly able to keep up with the demand for the training. Jochen has certified so far over 100 equine ergonomists worldwide. He's teaching in Brazil, he's teaching in Germany on a regular basis, and in Germany we have an international course where we have people come up from Dubai, Australia, all of the European countries around, and it's very, very exciting to become part of this global network. Just to quickly give you a little bit of a background on Jochen, that'll just give you a little bit of an idea of how passionate he is about what he does and why he actually came to forming Saddle Fit for Life.
Hi, I'm Jochen Schleser. My passion in life is to protect horse and riders from long-term damage caused by ill-fitting saddles.
There was a long period where I was a competitor, looked more as a horse as a machine. Yes, I had a certain relationship to my horse, but it was more so for me a vehicle, go from A to B and jump clean fences. It is a very hard thing to admit. I didn't see him. I didn't see him as an animal who has feelings, who has a soul. At that stage, I still did not know what I did with my equipment. We didn't have the technology. Veterinarians weren't that advanced to really x-ray the back or really looking into the horse's nerve damage. After I made already over 1,000 saddles, I got to see a video, a horse was galloping on the treadmill. Fiber optic camera injected underneath the saddle and the shoulder to see how the pressure with the saddle, incredible testing is done. And when I saw that, how the left shoulder got chopped off by the tree points, for me to think back how many saddles I made with what I thought was right, what I was being taught was right, I had to make a choice. Either continue the way I was or redo what I have done. And I need to get this information out to my fellow colleagues, saddle makers, saddle fitters, to all trainers, to all saddle manufacturers, to say we need to go back to the old system, the way we always made saddles, how we checked saddles, and stop crippling the horse long term.
The saddle can hit negative reflex points, causes reactions the horse cannot control. Here's some signs to look for it.
Sore sensitive back, overdeveloped bulge, under neck, tight back, dip in front of withers, moving down and away from pain, stressed abdominal muscle, tight barrel, hunter bump, kissing spine, white hair in the wither area, stumbling or tripping, cold back or cinchy, does he pin ears, rolls eyes or switch tail when saddling, your horse may be acting out because of pain, rearing or bucking, chomping at the bit, head tossing, reluctant to move forward, lack of engagement, not round, general bad attitude, resents work, pulls or roots down with their head, hollow stance back, full beat canter, refusing jumps, poor fitting saddle can cause poor position, discomfort and pain, lower back cramps, back pain and neck pain, pelvic pain, hip pain. Do you feel like you fight your saddle rather than using it to help you ride? Chair seat, crotch over, swinging legs, insecure, unstable in the saddle, saddle falling or leaning to one side, feeling behind or in front of the motion, knees, toes out, feeling twisted in the saddle, stirrup leather feel uneven, shoulders, hips, heels, out of alignment. Saddles are designed differently for men and for women. A male saddle has a narrow seat width, a narrow waist, and a wide twist. If a female rides in a male saddle with a wide twist, that will cause the knee to turn out, the toes to turn out, the leg to go forward with chronic hip pain and knee pain up to hip replacement. Well, when I finished my apprenticeship program, I was so happy that I was done with learning. And then my master said to me, "I'm over 60 years old. I stop learning when I look at the grass from the bottom up, when I'm under the ground." And I have to say, since 2006, I met so many very, very interesting people from every speck of the centrum. In saddle fitting, in different parts of saddle making, if it's Western, English, side saddles, racing saddles. But I think the most I learned from trainers. And I combined with veterinarians who have now technology what wasn't there before back then. It was more opinionated. And if we really go back 150 years ago, it was a matter of survival. And when I asked, many people said, from everything what really bothers you about saddle fitting, what is that, what's the most, what bothers you? Most common part is that there is so much information that I'm getting more confused than educated because there's so many different opinions. As a matter of fact, I'm shutting down, I'm getting confused, I maybe ignore it. When you travel the globe, you get with English pretty much everywhere around. And I thought, if we have today scientific evidence, this is a difference where a horse can be really perform or reacts. Who wants to have a horse who is constantly in the four-beat canter or all of a sudden start with a pace? Or the tongue comes out. Why do we want a horse who tries so hard to please you to... I remember my horse when he stumbled. I got so mad. And yet I didn't read him. And when I got introduced and the first time I saw that in Holland, the video, I saw my horse in front of me, and that was pretty hard to swallow. So when I started together and I said, it is really not the magic saddle or the magic fitting. It's a understanding why a saddle doesn't fit. I remember when I grew up, I took one saddle, I put it on every other horse. And back then, my mom opened a tack shop because she thought it's a little cheaper when you have this on wholesale base if the son runs around and tries to compete. And we got all these stuff in and we had magazines. But I really, maybe I didn't pay attention, but I don't know about you guys, there was never so much saddle fitting talk 20 years ago. 20 years ago, something new happened in the riding world. One of the things is that expect Brazil and Portugal, there are more women riding now than men, almost in every country. And if you make a product from a raw wood frame, what has steel inside, and you put webbing on top, and then you put foam on top, and you want to make sure you make a product what's very comfortable for you as a rider. After all, the customer looks at it in the tack shop, sits on top, and says, oh, this is comfortable, so I'm buying it. So every time when we, saddlers, make a saddle, we sit on top, wow, that's comfortable. But one thing what has never, well, there's a very few female saddlers, but the most saddles are made by men. When I sit on the saddle, I say to my students, shoulder, hips, and heels. Okay, she tries, he tries. And the difference between standing and sitting, if I push myself up, put my legs apart, that puts you in the center of the saddle. So when I stand, well, my weight is on my feet. When I sit, my weight is on my seat bone. Nothing changed. Right now, all of you sitting in the chair seat, you're sitting on the chair. And for riders, all of you guys know this is not really a riding seat. So for me to sit in the saddle, it's almost like they call it a standing seat. You're actually standing, but you're sitting on your seat bones. So when we make the saddle, for thousands and thousands of years, we know what to do. But then you ladies come around, and we have a new problem, which is you have four curves in your spine, and they are shock absorption. The difference in the female, the pelvis axis is way more forward, and for her to be balanced, she will always fall back. And I remember when I started in 78, we hardly had any needles on saddles, no high cantles, or these big, big, puffy panels in the back. They didn't exist until mid-late 80s. So we thought, oh, I know what the ladies need. Big, 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 big cantle. And when the leg goes forward, we just put a big, big, big block in front. And we just freeze her in this contraption, what doesn't look like a saddle anymore. Still didn't understand the girls. So this little mini clip shows you the medical explanation how you sit, stand in the saddle when you ride.
What happens from an anatomical point of view when a person achieves the desired state of suppleness in the pelvis? The brain sends signals to activate sinews, ligaments, and muscles, and harmonize them with the pelvis, thighs, and lower legs. The pelvis and the spine form the basis of the whole locomotor system of the body. This is where the basic position of the seat is determined, and everything else follows from this. From the side, the characteristic curvature of the spinal column is clearly visible. This curved shape has a definite purpose. It gives the spinal column the function of a sort of bearing spring, which supports the trunk, and, when bearing a load, it can yield a certain way in the vertical direction. The purpose of achieving a pliable seat is to preserve this curvature, which significantly increases the load-bearing capacity of the spinal column. The sacrum is a bone at the lower end of the spinal column. It does not consist of separate vertebrae, but ones which are fused together. The lumbosacral joint is to be found at the transition between the lumbar spine and the sacrum. As the last movable segment of the spine, it represents the interface between the flexible spine and the fixed pelvic ring. The sacrum is connected to the two hip bones via the iliosacral joint. Below this, there is the sciatic bone, which in its entirety maintains contact with the horse. The pubic bones of both sides join up in a cartilaginous joint, which can be felt at the lower end of the abdominal wall. Thus, the pelvic bones and the sacrum form a unit, a closed, fixed ring, whose individual components are practically immovable in relation to each other. That means that every movement or repositioning of the sacrum is always associated with a movement or repositioning of the entire bony pelvic ring. This fact is an important component and fundamental point for the understanding of the central importance of working with the pelvis. When a human being stands up, the weight of the body is transferred to the two hip joints. But when we are sitting in the saddle, the distribution of the load caused by the body is entirely different. The load is carried by the pelvic ring and lies on the sacrum and pubic bone branches. When the chest is raised and the shoulders allowed to droop, the spine settles almost automatically into a position in which complete suppleness can still be maintained in the saddle. The compensation for the backward and forward movements of the rider's pelvis takes place in the lower part of the lumbar spine. With a pliable seat, a perpendicular line from the head to the pelvis continues to the lower heel. The entire tilting action of the pelvis is carried out in the ischial tuberosities. These are rounded protrusions and always lie on the lowest point of the saddle. By moving the ischial tuberosities forwards and backwards, the rider can give impelling or restraining impulses. This important basic riding aid is a prerequisite for generating a harmonious flow of movement between human and horse. Many riders wrongly try to tilt the pelvic ring by activating the back muscles, but this is done exclusively by using the abdominal muscles, or to put it more exactly, using the muscles of the forward abdominal wall. The erector spinae, the back stretching muscle, plays the role of the corresponding antagonistic muscle. It is of the utmost importance not to cause the pupil any discomfort. With a cramped posture, it is impossible to achieve a pliable seat. Without a pliable seat, it is not possible to achieve oscillation in a horse's back. And if its back cannot oscillate, the horse will suffer pain and it will not be able to collect.
All right. Now, this was done at the Vienna Riding School. And when you sit in the saddle, and you would like to sit just like that's explained there, and you would like to move your legs independent from your seat, your upper body, and we all say, hey, my most important part is my seat. So how you bring your seat into the movement with the horse. Now, for most of the guys, we are actually very easy to move the legs independent really, really far back without any pain in the front. So it is really hard for a guy to understand where the underwear rubbing is, because if you look at a female pelvis, the seat bones are actually sitting a little higher than the front bones where you don't want to sit. And if you ride bareback and the horse has a little bit of a withers, you will not ever get close to your seat bones. It's amazing how many upper level riders are operated in L4, L5. Slip disc is a huge issue. Well, I'm good, I can hold it. Well, yeah, you're hurting yourself. So what the rider is doing, sit way, way back, and we call that area the swamp area. If you sit back in that saddle area, the worst part is, we also call it the trampoline. Now, part of what changed is that we have so many female riders. We have also many, many breeders who breed horses with much shorter backs, horses with long scapulars. The shoulder blades are very far back, so the horse has big, big movements. Or we see more and more Baroque horses. People buy the PRE horses, Lusitanos. And even people say, you know what, I got a Mustang. Well, where do you think that come from? When the Spaniard brought the horses over, Spanish horses. So the actual area of the saddle support area where we put saddles on gets smaller and smaller. Now comes the saddle maker who makes a pointy roof, and that's how we made saddles for 4,500 years. Back then, 1918, you weren't even allowed to ride a bicycle because we thought, ooh, women riding a bicycle, they're hurting their reproductive system.
You can hear part two of this two-part series with Joachim on next week's episode. And now, Jessica Ranshausen joins us with some training tips. These coincide with an article that was published in the November issue of Connection magazine. Jessica was inducted into the Rumor Foundation USDF Hall of Fame in 2001. And this segment comes to you as part of our series of American Dressage Legends.
Why don't we start with the stretching? So, in my history, long enough, I must say, really, I do interest my riders with particular horses. Horses that maybe have a bit of tension or maybe don't start out in their workups with a lot of flexibility. I encourage them to let the horses stretch down a little and come round but down a bit on a bit longer rein so that you see that the horse begins to move through the body better, more from behind, and that you still have enough relaxation within the frame of the horse so that all of the parts seem to flow a little better together. So I have been, over the years, encouraging my riders with horses that do have a bit of tension to go ahead, or older, it's also very good for older horses, to start out that way with a bit longer rein, a little bit lower in the front, and just so that they travel nicely through the body and also have a bit of relaxation. And I think it also helps with some riders who start out riding having some tension themselves. And that also goes for some of our disabled riders that start out a bit tense in their bodies. So altogether, it's a very nice way of starting the workout. Then we use those movements, the stretching, posting the trot, stretching on the big 20-meter circle, letting the horse stretch down in the middle of the test or through the in part of the test, that then reinforces the fact that the horse can go from being quite in quite a nice frame to, again, stretching down a bit and showing a certain amount of relaxation. And I think it's good from a pet's point of view and from the judge's point of view, it's a good way to see if the horse is really using his body properly, or is the horse a little tense, or does the horse not want to stretch. All of those things then color the way you feel about the horse starting through the test and riding through the movements in the beginning of the test. So I think all in all, it's a very good positive movement, and I really like it a lot.
I mean, obviously, that's very important because it helps to supple up the horse, doesn't it, and
help
them move through the back and that sort of thing. And then let's just talk about, you know, some of the other things to keep in mind every time you're schooling a horse, you know, making sure those transitions are very clear, precise, and well prepared for. Just give us some tips there, Jess.
Well, the other thing, too, is I encourage my riders, especially with young horses or, again, with horses that are a little tense, that they do plenty of transitions, and we do walk to trot, trot to walk. Sometimes you'll find that a horse that borders on being somewhat tense, if you put that in their daily routine and then use it when you get to the show, in the warm-up, you find out that the horse relates and says, oh, well, this is what I do at home, and I feel comfortable about it, so maybe I should feel comfortable about it here. And so sometimes these things that we do have a good extension. In other words, it follows through into a situation in which the horse might be a bit more tense or the rider might be a bit more nervous. And then you're able to use that, like the upward and downward transitions, you're able to use that along with the stretching to make the horse and rider feel more comfortable and to look more harmonious together. And I think that's very important for the rider preparing at a show to go down the center line in front of the judge.
Yes, it's getting them relaxed, isn't it, and in harmony.
Yep. And the harmony part of it is important because especially with a horse that has nice movement but tends to get a little bit tense, that's a way to really make the horse work over its back and to become more rideable. And that's part of that is important.
Well, very good point. Yes, of course. And then that suppleness is always going to help with the changing the direction, the bends, and so on.
Yes, and then on to your shoulder in, haunches in, all of those things, where the bend is so important. And we're looking to see that the horse remains in good sort of functioning from behind to the front, over the back, and comfortable enough so that it's a harmonious picture.
Well, another thing, of course, you have to do if you stretch and lengthen, you've got to shorten the reins at some point.
That's right. That's important also. And it's good because that 20-meter circle gives the rider, especially at the lower levels where the riders are maybe not so sure of themselves, it gives them a little bit of a point of where they begin the contact and bringing up the reins and shortening the reins. It gives them a little distance there at the end of the circle. They can start a little bit early to start drawing a little bit back and bringing the reins back so that you don't have the feeling of, my God, you get to a certain point and it's got to be right there. So that works in very nicely. That can be very harmonious as well.
Yes, because it's key when you're shortening the reins to make it look like it's very smooth, isn't it? And that you hardly move your hands. And that comes with experience too, doesn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. That's
so
true.
Any tips there for our novice riders who maybe, you know, maybe a little bit nervous in the middle of the test and get a little bit flustered?
Well, the thing, the particular figure, you mean?
Well, no, the shortening of the reins.
Oh, yes. Well, that's why I say that because it's lengthening the reins on the circle, then from the time that you've shown that, even if it's toward the end of the circle that the horse really begins to stretch nicely, you then have a bit of time generally to shorten the reins, have the horse come a little bit more together, and then prepare either for a downward transition or for a movement. And what I try to tell the riders is, you know, don't be afraid to pick up the reins a tiny bit early. Like if it says, okay, the circle goes from B to E to B, that when you come to B, it's not that you have to pick up the reins at B and make it a very abrupt move. You can start bringing the reins back, you know, at the quarter line, so that you're starting to bring the horse back under your, you know, under a little bit of a softer shortening of the rein, rather than having to do it all in two steps.
Well, I know one of the things a young horse will do when you're starting, you know, establish that contact, is they'll try and reach out of your hand, won't they? They'll try and
put their head straight in the air, yeah.
Yeah, they'll do all kinds of things to evade, because they don't quite get it. They're not quite, you know, they're at the beginning of their education. So any tips there in the schooling, Jess, for them to get past
Well,
that?
I always feel like if you know, let's say, if you're making a circle to the right and you're picking up your right rein a little bit more because you're on the circle and you're bending slightly to the right, and so you're picking up your reins and then the horse starts to be a little bit unsteady, maybe raising his head, you then want to be able to separate your hands a little bit and maybe move the bit in the horse's mouth as you're picking him up, move the bit a little bit on the outside rein to help the horse come a little rounder without the feeling that, oh my goodness, you know, there's a lot of pressure everywhere. But also by separating the hand, it's a little bit more of a wider base of support, which sometimes will help to keep the horse from, you know, being too abrupt.
Because with them bringing the head up, the back hollows, and you know, all the knitting comes undone, right?
Yep. And you think about your hands being a little bit more like side reins.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, any other tips there, Jess, that would be helpful for our listeners in just establishing those basics?
Well, the other thing that I think is so important is really using your ring to make your movements the best you can. For example, let's take the shoulder in, and you're coming through the corner, and you have to start your shoulder in. Let's say it's from H to E, and then at E you're going to turn left, and at B you're going to turn right. Well, what I try to do is to say to the riders at first, when they're very green, we try to make, for example, a 10-meter circle at H so that you get the bend without having to be too abrupt with a lot of leg pressure and so on for the shoulder in. Then, after you have that, you go from that circle into the shoulder in where you're able, the horse already has the inner bend and you're using a little bit your inner leg to your outer rein a little bit more. And that can be a steadying thing, also with the idea that the upper body of the rider is going a little bit more down the track and not dropping the inner shoulder. So there are all those little things that you're thinking will help to make it a smooth transition. So what the end result is that when you come through the corner and you get your bend in the inner rein through the corner, then as you come out of the corner with your body going, your upper body going more down the track, and what Reiner Klimke told me years ago when we used to have the shoulder in and the intermediate one, he said, always remember when your outside kneecap is on the line, on the center line, you know you have the right angle. So I tell my riders, when you have your outside knee going down the track, you have the right angle for the shoulder in.
That's a very good tip. Well, on that note, Jess, I'll remind our listeners that this article in the USDF's Connection magazine November issue does include some of that information as well, in letting the horse take the reins and the process of stretching and the topics that Jessica has just touched on very briefly for us this week. Jessica, thank you very much indeed for coming on the program.
No, not at all. It was fun.
And a reminder, with just 3 weeks to go now to the start of the Adequan USDF Annual Convention on December the 3rd through the 6th, that convention takes place in Boston, Massachusetts, and you can find more information and register online on the website at usdf.org. And whilst you're on the website, be sure to visit eTrack.com. the USDF's online learning center and resource for dressage and equine education. And a reminder that the USDF official podcast is available on iTunes for download from the iTunes store to your smartphone podcast apps. The USDF is your connection to the American dressage community.